Hello, Cleveland.
Yes.
Are we ready?
My name is Mudge, and I'm from a little hacker group up in Boston called The Law.
I don't know how many people here are familiar with The Law.
Woohoo! Yay!
The Law Groupie.
The cool thing is The Law Groupie back there was Bruce Schneier, and that's saying something.
What does The Law do? A little bit of background on The Law. The Law started in about 1992. We had pretty much known each other since the mid-80s. All of us have met online and we found ourselves in the same geographic location up in Boston, all hanging out, plunging through MIT or trying to audit their classes on Telephony 101. We found that all of us had reached critical mass of junk and equipment and used computer parts, and our wives and significant others were sick and tired of it, taking up the kitchen sink, filling up the bathtub, and they said, you know, get the stuff out or you get out. And we all rented a loft space in the south end of Boston. And as we were using it for storage, we started seeing what everybody else had. Like, oh, you have products. Ooh, I've got bars here. They work together. Let's hook this stuff up. And some projects started coming out of it, and it became a little hangout area. It's been kind of growing ever since then, where we're doing more serious projects, a bunch of stuff in wireless communications, some satellite communications, the police mobile data terminals, secure code auditing, loft crack type things, little tweaks on NT, F-key, whatever. Whatever looks interesting. We also found that it's much more politically correct if we set up the environment locally and break into them, as opposed to breaking into somebody else's and risk running or going to jail. Although recently we've seen that it's very difficult, unless certain exceptions, obviously, for anybody to prosecute hackers. There is this entire thing called an elevation of privilege, which it's just an elevation of privilege. You're running a web server, you're running it as nobody, somebody breaks in as nobody, elevates the privileges to root, guess what? Good luck sending them to jail.
That's just an elevation of privileges, and you're not going to get them on it. At least that's what some of the guys at Washington told us. And they're the ones supposed to be making the laws. But so you can yell at them, and Marcus Raynham has the best story about that one, which is, you know, you call them up and say, knock it off, or I'm coming to your house and killing you. Which, I don't know about the legality of that one either, but... Okay, anyway, well, we can field questions on The Law much later. Everything's available on the website. Next slide. So VPNs. Well, VPN seems to be the phrase that everybody's bantering around. And when Jeff wrote me an email going, Mudge, you know, will you come give a talk? I'm like, I don't know what to talk about. I'm sick and tired of talking about loft crack. I'm sick and tired of talking about the Microsoft botching crypto and the use of old Landman and the backwards compatibility stuff. It's been beaten into the ground. So I said, well, VPNs was one of the choices to choose from. I'll choose that. And Bruce Schneier and I recently did a paper entitled Cryptanalysis of PPTP, Microsoft's PPTP, which, of course, went right back to the old Landman and backwards compatibility and all the other problems. But VPNs, what are they? How many people here have heard the phrase VPN? How many people are deploying or using a VPN? How many people are confused as to exactly what a VPN is? Okay, a couple. How many people think that frame relay clouds are VPNs? They're trying to sell them that way. There's a big difference between virtual network and virtual private network. Microsoft PPTP is a virtual network. So what are they? They're mechanisms for treating remote objects in disparate zones as part of one central unit. I just wanted to use big words and seem like I knew what I was talking about. It's extending your perimeter. That's what it is. It's taking a remote node and treating it as if it's still internal, whether that's through encryption, whether that's through routing tricks, or what have you. Ostensibly, the privacy part would come in when you are trying to hide your information, or at least do strong authentication. Of course, that's not much privacy there if you can see all the other transactions after it. I've seen just about every market droid out there running around trying to sell something called VPNs, whether it's at a layer 2 where it's really a virtual LAN, all the way to people selling frame relay clouds and saying, well, this is basically a virtual network, or TDM devices, or any sort of multiplexer saying, well, you're getting a little slight of a virtual network. What the hell? Ethernet is a virtual network then. Next slide. So here we have the wonderful virtual private network example. And we'll see if this actually reaches. And you can play with the screen monitor. This is always a bad thing. They would keep me away from the whiteboard. So here we have, you know, home base. This is where everybody wants to be. This is your internal corporate network. The problem is you just bought a company for, you've got a remote sales office, which is all 3 users, and you're not going to spend the however hundreds of thousands of dollars or tens of thousands of dollars or whatever if you work for the phone company to run a lease line from California over to Hong Kong. So the obvious solution is you use existing infrastructure, such as the internet, and you tunnel it, and you treat this remote office and as a virtual pipe, and hopefully you're controlling the filter rules on this, which usually isn't the case. So everybody's at the exact same security level. Then you have the wonderful person with the remote laptop that's traveling around sales is why he needs to get the print services, needs the files, needs whatever. So everybody wants to sell you a solution for this. Save money, use the internet. Well, we all know the internet's broken. The internet's 20 years old, you should not use the internet anymore. It's not designed to make money off of. That's a pretty slide. Okay, next slide. Any questions on that one? Why use them? Virtual corporations. There are a whole bunch of virtual corporations out there. This is the cool thing about networks. You don't have to sit in the office. You can sit at your house. You can, you know, sit outside. You can be sitting there with your little Waveland card at the beach, connected up. You can be doing your MOIP stuff if you're in the government. Dial-in users. Oh, dial-in users, dial-in. First time I'm seeing these slides also. If you're going through an ISP, I think I was trying to say dial-in users to ISPs so that you're spending your $9.95 a month to go through Errol's internet, and as opposed to spending your $600-$800 a month to run the VPN through T1 directly over to whatever cost. Eliminate the cost of lease lines, obviously, remote locations being the prime example. It's always a sales office that needs access to everything for marketing. So next one. Where is the critical security components? Well, a lot of people don't think about this. Virtual private network, private being the key word here, authentication. Well, if you look at a lot of the VPNs, they're going to be, how do you want to authenticate? Is passwords? Are passwords okay? Just plain text passwords across the internet? I mean, hopefully we've learned. It took 20 years for SSH to come out, although SSH might have problems. It's 20 years to get rid of Telnet and sending your passwords over the network. They're going to do it all over again here. Encryption. Is the encryption done correctly? I mean, Bruce will sit here and talk to you at length and say, probably not. It's probably not done right. And I'll sit here and talk to you at length saying, I don't care. They might have the strongest encryption in the world. Nobody implements correctly. You know, they're using a POPEN somewhere down in the code. They're using a system call. They're using whatever. They've got a buffer overflow. They crash when you send a big packet in. Who cares? If you actually get to the point where you're concerned about the encryption being sound and only attackable through brute force key space searches, you did pretty well. Chances are it's going to fail long before it even gets up to that. Security of a remote node. Does anybody find it ironic that all the laptops that are traveling around the world are running Windows 95? And Microsoft says Windows 95 is not secure by NT. However, here's the VPN to extend your perimeter and it runs on Windows 95. These are mutually exclusive terms. If you can't secure the end node, then it can't be an extension of your perimeter. Then the security of local nodes. Local node is a bit of a misnomer. What I'm trying to say with local node is the actual tunnel server or the private network server. In the case of PPTP, it'll be the PPTP server. In the case of Digital's I can't remember the name of it right now off the top of my head, the Altavista tunnel. It would be the server inside your corporate firewall, or else dual-homed with an external and an internal-facing interface. Then this thing called a control channel, which we saw in PPTP, and I'm using PPTP as an example because of the recent paper, but what do you do for flow control? What do you do for key negotiation? What do you do for resynchronization of the crypto keys? What happens if things come out of order? These are all things you really need to worry about. Is the control channel in band? Is it out of band? If it's in band, you've got problems. If it's out of band, you've got other problems you need to think about and worry. Other gets kind of interesting, but other is the catch-all. It is, are there information leaks? How much stuff information does this give out? What can I learn about your company from it? Is the software made in a reliable fashion? Did the company do any sort of due diligence testing? Can you hold the company liable? No. Next slide. VPN security authentication. If this first bullet is new to anybody, you should probably very quietly excuse yourself. Is it proprietary? Well, I don't know. Maybe checkpoints, encryption stuff that's proprietary is pretty good. I don't know. Maybe the scuttlebutt on the hill that they are actually an entire front for the Mossad is true also. Who knows? Why don't they let you see it? This is my big gripe with Security Dynamics also. And a whole bunch of other companies. Is it extensible? Well, if they've got really poor authentication built into how they distribute the initial pieces of software, but they give you the option to put your own hooks in or somebody else's hooks in that have been tried and true, this is a pretty good thing. PPTP by itself is not really flawed. It's Microsoft's MSChaff, Microsoft's point-to-point encryption, and Microsoft's compression stuff that they license from Stack Electronics. It's their extensions that are really broken in it. However, the caveat to that is if they are pushing something out that's broken, even if it's extensible, everybody's going to use the broken components. The authentication. If it's plain text, I mean, what? Get rid of the word private. If anybody's going to see it, they're going to be able to authenticate as that person. Public key, private key. This is standard stuff. What would you do for the actual authentication mechanism? In band or out of band is kind of interesting. I use the example of how Security Dynamics ACE server works as an example of out of band authentication. I know it's not necessarily a VPN technology, but it is an authentication technology that you could use inside of VPNs. I recently had a case to set up an SSH server for a company in Massachusetts, which was kind of their gateway to their inside systems. And we said, well, it's really a shame to be using these reusable passwords inside of SSH. And the company had already, many years ago, signed up with Security Dynamics, and they weren't willing to get rid of them on my recommendation alone. So we said, okay, well, we'll put the secure ID cards inside the SSH tunnel. This is great. Now the session won't be able to be hijacked because it's encrypted. There won't be able to be session injection unless you talk to Ivan and realize that there's a problem with the checksums that are being done. Thank you, Ivan. Actually, that was a really cool hack. If anybody hasn't seen it, please go to SecNet. Is it up on SecNet's advisory? Which can still be reached at www.secnet.com, right? Okay, now there's a really good SSH advisory that everybody, if you haven't seen it, it's very clever. But anyway, back to the in-band or out-of-band. So I was all excited. Here we have these quote-unquote one-time passwords that prove that you actually have your card and that your card cannot be copied. And I'm authenticating inside this encrypted tunnel so nobody can see it, nobody can hijack it, nobody can erase the last digit. Until all of a sudden I realized that the actual server that I'm typing my password into, my six-digit, four through eight-digit code, is backending out on some high UDP port to talk to the server outside of the SSH tunnel. If anybody knows the long-term dev key from this machine, they can authenticate inside the nice encrypted tunnel. So in band and out of band, I mean, if they're doing an out of band one, you got to watch and see where it's going. It might not be what you were expecting. It wasn't what I was expecting. I just didn't think about it. So we had to actually move the location of the machine. In band, out of band, obvious. Next slide, please. So another example of poor authentication. And I was continually saying I don't want to talk about LogCrack and LANMAN passwords, but here we go. Standard example of MSChat is the client requests a logon challenge. It says, hey, I am user mudge at whatever domain. So any path admin looper can say, oh, well, now I know the user's name, and I also know what domain he's potentially in. Or she. Service is designated by challenge. I'd like to see, Paul Leach was talking about NPLM++ the other day, and he briefly went into the pseudorandom number generator, and I'd be very interested in Microsoft going public and showing the pseudorandom number generator they're using for the state by challenge inside the network authentication for their LANMAN mentee. Gee, I wonder why. Client does encrypt the LANMAN mentee dial attached to the state by challenge, which isn't too bad, and sends them back to the server. The problem is you see both the LANMAN and the mentee dial attached. The LANMAN hash was all uppercase and is basically broken down into breaking a group of 7 and a group of 7. The NT hash, whereas it can be set up to be 128 characters in length for the user's password, and I admit I don't know if there were some comments on this the other day, while you can type it in on the initial login screen of NT, if you go to User Manager, which is a nice little GUI they give you, which is where all of your NT administrators do their changing of people's passwords, that one limits you to 14 characters, so they can't set it to more than 14, so you're still limited there. By the way, it's about 128 that are 40 bits worth of entropy. It's the entropy of the password that the user chooses, because that's what this is all based off of. Server looks at the client hash, encrypts it with the 8-byte challenge, and just then compares the results. If you want to see how this works, grab LogCrack. LogCrack will sniff the network, grab the 8-byte challenge, the response, and go through and give you back the person's password, usually. In PPTP, it's just looking for it in a different place. Tomorrow, that's not starting tomorrow or the day after. Tomorrow we should be releasing a new version of LogCrack, which includes the PPTP sniffer, so you can grab people's PPTP connections and also get the passwords out of those also, along with some performance improvements and enhancements. But of course. We're also releasing the tool that allows you to model PPTP servers to see a company's utilization specs or usage. The encryption, stream ciphers over datagrams. Stream ciphers, which expect everything to be coming in order, which really like things to be in order, going over transport protocols that won't guarantee anything shows up in order, if at all. This usually isn't a good combination. Rekeying is a mess. Now, block ciphers. Block ciphers have some problems with them. Stream ciphers are just something, in this case, I stay away from. And we noticed, we don't know why they chose RC4 in this. It is quick. Proprietary, obviously. I'm screaming. How frequently is it rekeyed? There's a lot of discussion about this, and I'm not the cryptographic whiz that a lot of the other people in this room are. So take the things I have to say on this aspect with a couple bags of salt. And the rekeying, a lot of people are going, well, I have to sit in management meetings once in a while, believe it or not. And they're saying, well, how frequently is a rekey? Oh, it rekeys every 256 packets, or it rekeys whenever you ask it to, or it rekeys every 30 minutes, or it rekeys every packet. All these people, you know, the marketing people from these companies will tell you all those different things. When do you want it to rekey? If I wanted to rekey every packet, I'm not going to expect a really fast product. I'm not really sure that it's going to be an extremely secure product. I don't know when you should rekey. I don't think you should do it every packet. I think time-based is probably not a bad idea. Amount of traffic probably be good, but I think it's an overused evaluation model, and I think there are more important things to be looking at as a
opposed to when it's being rekeyed. How is it being rekeyed? Can anybody request it to be rekeyed? In the case of Microsoft, you could request it to be rekeyed. You could request it to be rekeyed with the same key it was using before, over and over and over again. For people who aren't familiar with RC4 tremendously, RC4 is a really nice random number generator that they just use to produce a nice pseudo-random number, and they XOR things. If you XOR things against the same thing over and over and over again, you eventually figure out what they XOR it against. This means it's not encrypted anymore. Unique keys per direction. Unique keys per direction. If you XOR something once, it might as well be twice as secure if you XOR it twice, right? What was the phrase? I don't know, Bruce, it's a bad mojo. A bad karma. Error correction and recovery. What happens if you drop packets? If you are using some sort of feedback loop, packets are important. They depend upon each other. If you're using something that stands alone, how do you know which key it was encrypted with? Can you request it to come back to you? Error correction and recovery is important. The internet is lossy. It does send things out of order. Your local network might not. You might watch your local network and you might not see a packet come out of order for ages. Yeah, maybe some of these things would work better on a local network, but VPNs, by definition, have to be out across the internet. Okay, next slide. An example of the encryption. Microsoft point-to-point encryption, and I refuse to talk about 128-bit Microsoft products because any company, any large company that's using Microsoft products or NT, and I know I'm kind of slamming on Microsoft, but they bring it on themselves a lot. They still have the bullish attitude, and it's kind of fun. And they slam on us and whatever. In fact, it's seven little punks involved, and you can get a very small rise, or fix it out of them. Makes it all worthwhile. Anyway, the 128-bit stuff, I tried to get a copy of the 128-bit code to do some research, and I had to actually mail to them and wait for what ended up being a couple months to get the CD in the mail. I couldn't just say, you know, hey, I'm coming from a US.gov site. I'm probably an American citizen, or you can probably give me the 128-bit stuff. On top of that, everybody else is using the 40-bit because it's quick. You can download it, you run 40-bit. They don't want to have interoperability problems, so the 128-bit server will go back down to 40-bit. If you have companies overseas, or you're talking to people overseas, or you're expecting to make money through communication transactions overseas, those people are ostensibly using the 40-bit product if it's from Microsoft. And since the internet, the great thing about it is you can make money all over the place, and it doesn't matter if you're a U.S. citizen or whatever. 40-bit is what you're willing to talk about. So if they generate a deterministic 64-bit key from the landman hash, here's your entropy, which is the user's password, of the user's password using SHA. Then they set the higher order 24 bits of the key to D1269E. D1269E. I'm looking to see if any of the spooks actually stand up and know we gave them that number. If anybody wants to tell me what this number, what the significance of that is, why it's not AAAA or A1B2C, I'd really, really, really like to know. This person that I was talking to, and I sat down and wrote it out in ASCII, wrote it out in binary to try and see any sort of patterns to it, and it doesn't make much sense. So maybe the agency says, set the high order bit to this because we can key off of this somehow. I don't know. It's kind of neat. So that drops it down to 40 bits. No takers. Nobody's willing to tell me. Bye. Okay. Oh, the rekeying. So they do it every 256 packets. They do. This is PPTP from a couple of months ago. My understanding is they offer different mechanisms of rekeying at this point. I don't know. This was an example at the time, and I'm just showing examples of the encryption and the rekeying in virtual private network software, VPN tunnels. A lot of people are still using this older software. As we all know, once a piece of buggy software or vulnerable software gets out, it's almost impossible to recall at all. So they take the 64 bits and the previous key and the original key, so they basically increment the key based upon whatever the last one was. Set the higher order bits, obviously, to drop it down to 40 bits from the 64. Some of the problems that were existing in this was that if you got packets out of order, they would instantly rekey to the same key that they were just using. Since they do it every 256 packets, and they have a counter inside the GRE header, which is basically just doing mod 56, if I either dropped a packet or scooped a packet, this is not inside the encryption stub, this is inside the GRE header, so it would get to it without any sort of authentication, they would rekey for me. It would say, I'm out of order, let's rekey. And if you kept rekeying over and over and over and over again, basically you weren't incrementing the key. This is the correct way of doing it, of saying, hey, after 256 packets, we increment forward, but they would actually stand still if a problem occurs. And as we all know, problems happen. Remote node. This is why I think VPNs just don't work. I don't think people understand what they're doing. This is something Taper didn't talk about in PPTP very much, but we noticed a lot of very bizarre problems with it. You have a remote device sitting on a network, an external, untrusted network. Otherwise, you don't need a virtual private network. And it's talking to some sort of tunnel back into your corporation. You appear to have an internal IP address. The server is basically proxying out that, responding to the IP and forwarding back over the tunnel to your client. Who are you talking to? Is your interface still addressable on this external unsecure network? Most places thought about this. They try and disable, or they give you the option of saying, only talk to my local sub through the tunnel. That's pretty good. What happens to the hardware stuff? Have they turned off the response to ARPS? Have they turned off, what happens if I am sending a packet with your Ether address, and inside the packet, I've got an IP address of an internal machine, or I'm gratuitously ARPing as one of the machines inside the tunnel. I don't know how many people play with gratuitous ARPs. Gratuitous ARPs are basically saying, who has me, tell me, and who has A, tell A, as opposed to who has C, tell A, or B, tell A. Everybody believes these, and they update their tables. We've noticed that the Windows 95 client, just by sniffing the local network, would get very confused and would ARP sometimes as its internal tunnel address on the one interface out, and sometimes it would ARP as an external interface over going to the server. This doesn't make sense. This is wrong. This is scary stuff. You're doing this to remain private on an untrusted network. Now all of a sudden you know what you are. You're a router. What happens to weird packets like source routing? Does it believe source routing? What about packet forwarding? By definition, you have to be forwarding packets somewhere. Hopefully you're not forwarding packets on your external interface over the tunnel. But you have two IP addresses now. You've got an internal tunnel IP address, and you've got the IP address that you are connected to your ISP with. This means you forward packets. Even if it's entirely local inside the machine, it's going through loopback or whatever, and you're sending it back out, you are forwarding packets. Forwarding packets is a scary thing. There's a reason that you're doing the tunnel. You've got a firewall set up so people can't, you know, forward their own packets through your firewall, yet now here you are sitting out there. Is it crashable? When we were looking at BPTV, I'll keep using that because that was the example that we did, we came up with some really, really neat ideas for attacks. The problem is, we couldn't test them because every time we sent packets to it to try and test it, the thing crashed and blue screened on us. It'd be interesting to see when they fix the stuff, or maybe that's the way they, you know, they fail safe. Our problems, we talked about that already. The local node, in other words, the server, the optimistic tunnel, the firewall one box, the gauntlet box doing whatever, the sunscreen, the, you know, you name it. It has to be accessible to everybody. This is why you're running the VPN on your Windows 95 box as you walk around the country. You don't know where you're going to be, but you want to pop up and you want to be inside on the internal network. And if you're not accessible to anyone, it's not really a tremendously useful. product for large-scale corporations. You got to wonder what the server is willing to say.
This is now a new hole through your perimeter. This is now a new insight into your network.
Does it give out number of open channels? Will it tell you statistics about itself? Will it tell you domains? Will it tell you what types of encryption it's willing to negotiate? Information is a good thing to get in this place. It's a bad thing to give out, but if you're attacking it, it's a good thing to get. Does it properly handle unexpected data? This sounds like the most simple thing to request. Do you gracefully throw away garbage when you get it? And this is not just Microsoft. This is everybody out in the industry. I have no clue why people are expecting that they will only get legitimate data, especially out on the internet. If anybody has access to the different mails, the different apps, or whatever, I highly recommend, just for educational purposes, take a sampling of the network traffic, if you're allowed to, or from your own company, or if you're transit. Not to look inside the packets, just to look inside the headers to see what's actually being forwarded along. You will find raw streams of ASCII characters that are being rabbled across the internet. Honest to God, you will. You will find things that have 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, 41, and they get handed along. Because it says, at some point it's going, all right, who's got net 41? And this is all A. I'm sure people are seeing B's and C's and B's. There's a complete overabundance of garbage and bad data. Not to mention that people will mess up. People will write buggy implementations of clients that talk to you. And it's not at that point that the client made an illegal request. So when we botched our security, it was because of an illegal client request. Trust the client to send in the wrong stuff. It will. Don't fail on it. There was an ACM Journal article many, many years ago. Probably like 10, 15 years ago. And they took a look at Unix systems at the time and applications and programs inside of it. And they sent garbage to these programs to see how many would fail in a sane fashion, just say, hey, that wasn't what I expected. And some of them crashed the entire system. They just generated a pseudo-random buzz generator and sent it as input. Well, guess what? Hackers do this when they're looking to see how vulnerable a piece of code is. If I can send in garbage, if I can connect to a TCP port or UDP port, bang on the keyboard, and have the server either crash or the service go away or the CPU utilization shoot up 99% as it's trying to process this, I don't trust the code. And I sure as hell don't trust it to be an extension of my perimeter. I think I gave the talk, the rant yesterday. I don't know if anybody, some people might have been there, some people might not have. I'd really love to see these large software companies being held liable. When I've gone in and talked to them, as soon as you say liable, maybe this is a useful bit of information to people. Liable is not the word to use. As soon as you say liable, liable means you will lose money. Liability, that's no good. If you go in and say the same thing, but use the word incentives, incentives, we might be able to get something out of this for ourselves. Give them incentives to write secure code. Give them incentives to look at their code. Give them incentives to have other people do peer reviews of it, to do real quality testing from an attack standpoint, because everybody else out there is going to. You're relying on it. Any effort to ensure the security of the client? This is a tricky thing to do, but if it was a perfect world, I don't know if Theo's around. Theo had a really good analogy. If everybody in the world were running OpenBSD, we could start looking to ensure the security of clients when they make connections and say, oh, you're running this silly program, I'm not going to talk to you. On the SSH gateway that I was talking about, one of the things that we decided to do is we noticed a lot of people would telnet to a machine that had SSH, so that they could SSH and connect in. We noticed the security consultants of this company doing this. The SSH gateway now makes a connection out. It's a silly thing, it's trivial, and it doesn't work wonderfully well, but it's at least a step in the right direction. And it looks to see if port 23 is listening on the other machine. If it is, it says, forget it, you can't come in. You're coming from a machine that accepts unencrypted connections, and now you want to talk to me encrypted. I don't trust the entire endpoint point-to-point are secure. Might be interesting to see if some of these VPN technologies will start doing that. Geez, you're coming from a Windows 95 client and you happen to have shared all of your directories to the world. Maybe I don't want to trust you coming in. Maybe I'll tell you, hey, please turn this stuff off and try and reconnect. Maybe it's not possible. See, this is why it's not perfect. I also set up on the lock 423 is running SSH. But for most places out there, there is no perfect solution. There's no silver bullet for it. You try and do a little incremental fixes. The fail-safe mode is a fail open or close. We notice a lot of switches that we're trying to do secure VLANs, which is kind of similar to VPN. And they would fail open. They tend to fix the problems and they're failing close, which is good. But this is always something you have to ask about. Can policies be enforced on the server? Or is this another case of client-side security? Client-side security. Well, that worked really well for NFS, didn't it? It worked really well for RecD, didn't it? I need to be able to say, this is what you have to connect to. If you have the option of enforcing security, do it. If you can enforce, strong encryption and strong authentication, do it. If you say, I give you the option of strong encryption, but I also give you the option of negotiating for none or a lower one, lowest common denominator, you lose. Somebody will wait for you to come in with the weak encryption or the none encryption. This is like SSH. SSH shipped with the option for encryption type none. Nobody else is catching the irony out of that, although. So this is an important thing. What information is leaked during the setup? I like little tidbits of info. It's kind of neat to ping a machine and see what comes back inside the, or get pinged by a machine and see what it's sending as the arbitrary data. It's neat to see what sort of like time delays are set, what sort of what flags are set or accepted on boxes. You can learn information about machines and about people in all sorts of strange ways. I think in the next slide we talk about some of the information we were able to get just looking at the TPTP server without ever trying to attack it or go into it, but just say, hey, you're willing to talk to me? Who are you? What do you know? Tell me about yourself. They're chatting. So how are the control messages authenticated? If you have a control channel, it has to be authenticated. Control is an important thing. If it's doing rekeying, if it's saying, hey, I'm setting up a new session, I've got session teardown inside of here, you don't want people to be able to spoof these things in. This is an important thing to authenticate. What would happen if the information inside the control channel was falsified? If it's not authenticated, anything the falsifier wants to do. A lot of this should be common sense, and I feel a little bad that I have to sit up here and say stuff that should be common sense, but guess what? Nobody out in the industry seems to be doing anything about it. So I hope it's not the next 5 years that I'm standing around giving talks going, don't use Git as your code, don't use system to be open, if you skip bad garbage, don't crash. But it's not going away. This is very disappointing, disheartening. Asymmetric routes are really an interesting thing going on, actually. So I guess the information leads us on the next page. So let's skip over to the next one, which is an asymmetric route example. We'll get to the BBTP information leads in a second. Okay. Everybody know what an asymmetric route is? Anybody running stateful firewalls? Anybody willing to tell me if you're running a stateful firewall? Tom, you want to tell me how good stateful firewalls are? I like stateful firewalls. I think they're a step in the right direction. I know there are certain people who really disagree with me. One of the most interesting challenges with stateful firewalls is what happens if you get an asymmetric route. For those people who aren't familiar with the notion of a stateful filter as opposed to an unstateful filter, Cisco routers, if they say, when you're using them for some sort of firewalling mechanism, which routers, not firewalls, the good routers. These are things called stateless firewalls. They look at one individual packet and they say, I either have a rule saying based upon the flags and the information in this individual unique packet, I have no notion of it going anywhere else, or if it's attached to any other stream, I will either pass it or deny it. And you might say, well, what about established? You know, established says, hey, I already know you're part of the stream. All established is doing is saying this packet does not have a SYN flag set in it. It's got either a SYN ACK or ACK or anything else. This is not really stateful. This is looking at each individual unique packet. We can send in a whole slew of ACKs and they'll get in there. Hopefully the end node won't do anything with them. Hopefully the end node will just drop them. Now obviously you can start using a little bit of imagination and realizing that one of the reasons that intrusion detection is so difficult is because you don't know how the end node is going to handle this stuff. And if you're stateless and you let stuff go through, you're trusting that the end node will do the right thing. Anyway, back to a stateful filter will actually set up a state table and say, I see a packet going in, I'm expecting a packet coming back from that address, I have a table entry here for the notion of stateless protocols like UDP. What they do is they kind of sleeve it and they say, I saw something go out from port, let's say, 10,000, and it was going to port 70 from machine A to machine B. I now expect within X amount of time a packet coming back from port 70 up to port 10,000. So I'm keeping this as a very small window. It's not truly stateful, but it's a step in the right direction to minimize the amount of time that something's open, to allow internal connections to go out and get the responses back, but not allow externally initiated communications to terminate on internal machines. You end up having to model the way the protocols work, which instantly breaks when you get to FTP. But what you gonna do? Or whenever you try and talk to one of the machines. So, asymmetric route. Let's assume that this person right there is a stateful, some sort of stateful packet filter. If this is part of company, this is all part of company A. Part of company A. If we have two connections to the internet, and I have a packet to go out this way from this machine, and it comes back in that way, that's an asymmetric route. Get back in a different direction than it went out. If you're trying to keep state tables of packets that are going back and forth, this becomes very difficult because it came in somewhere else. It's a neat challenge. You could work on trying to sync them up. Most likely, it's not really that tricky, or it's not really worth the effort. It is a bit tricky. So if you try and just have the packets go this way and minimize the number of asymmetric routes, this becomes quite difficult for large corporations, but it's possible. So here I am, Janet user, sitting out on the internet with my VPN. So my external internet address is, we'll say, what's a good one? I didn't write on some big company. And it's going to another company I really hate. Anybody ever send out traffic to Net 10 from your local ISP? You get responses. Sometimes. Sometimes it goes a long way out in the big old cloud of the internet before somebody says, okay, so Janet's dialed up, and she's got this VPN tunnel. So she's got an internal address of 192.168.2.2. Because they put their routers up on like high numbers or something, I don't know. And her ISP address is net 10. And let's say that Janet wants to spoof a packet, and she wants to come from, MIT's not A, right? MIT never gets into trouble like this. No. So she spoofs the packet internally, saying, I'm at A. Go to them because this VPN server is already behind the firewall. The firewall stateful, or the filter, I should say, is stateful. The filter is going to allow this communication coming from net A going out to some other, going to this other network. So it's now making the stateful route. Well, you've got an asymmetric problem here. You're breaking the firewall. These are weird things that can happen. Some of these end up being exploitable once you start thinking about them. Does assume that you've already gotten access to the filter, but what happens to asymmetric routes is something that you really need to think about in this situation. If none of you are using stateful filters, forget it, I just wasted your time for the past 5 minutes here. The bit flipping attacks or checksum collision problems. This was going on about, for instance, on RC4, you can flip arbitrary bits. It doesn't really care. It'll try and reassemble it. The checksum stuff, I was thinking of SSH with Ivan's advisory. SSH is basically a virtual private network because you can tunnel just about anything through it other than UDP, which I hear they're working on actually. The specs for SSH are out there, so if anybody is really, really using SSH, the client, you might think about having your R&D or somebody internally develop a stripped down version that just does the actual protocol back and forth as opposed to all the other stuff inside of SSH. It's worthwhile. I love SSH, you know, I swear by it, but it's got everything in the kitchen sink in there. Passive monitoring, we'll talk about that in just a second. Offline attacks, how long does it take me to get the traffic and basically piece it back together? Now, some people asked me, they said, why would I want to do an offline attack if I can figure out in the instance of Microsoft, I've got an attack going against the authentication mechanism, I can authenticate against the user. Well, let's say once this user is authenticated inside the encrypted stream, they're authenticating to other resources inside the corporation that you know the malicious person wants to get to. This is where the offline attack might be fruitful to figure out what those plain text, because hey, they're already in on the secure machine inside. We're going to trust them. Passwords work. Traffic analysis. I don't know of any VPNs that are generating bogus traffic to try and defeat this, to figure out where things are going. Traffic analysis can be very, very interesting. We did an analysis of a very large VPN server to see exactly when people were logging in, what the high utilization was. Obviously, if we have this metric done up and it fluctuates or varies, we know something interesting is going on inside of the company. This is the same thing as ham radio operators notice when they're watching satellites, and all of a sudden the satellites aren't accessible anymore. Guess what? The government came in. Something hot is going on. Or if you go down to certain agencies and, you know, day in, day out, same routine, and the next thing you know, there's like pizza delivery trucks lined up left and right. Pizza analysis is probably the best way of figuring out what's going on inside of a company. This is what we got from passively monitoring PPTV. Just taking a look. Watching the client authenticate. We got the client machine IP address. You have to. We've got to communicate with the server somehow. The server machine IP address obviously has to communicate back, has to be where they're going to talk to. The number of virtual tunnels the server has available. Nobody needs to know this. I now know how big of a server you have. If you're running and you say, got a wimpy machine, we don't have many people out there, I don't need more than 10 virtual nets that I can allocate out. Or if you see one that says, hey, I've got 200 that I can allocate out. The strange thing is, each time one's allocated, it'll hand out and it'll say, now I've only got 9. So you start watching the utilization patterns. 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, people are logging in. Maybe it's noon, people are logging in. And you can see when the majority of people are going into the server. Either this is a very good time to try and attack it because you've got a lot of noise around you, or this is a very bad time to attack it because there are people watching. It depends. You've got to look a little bit at the company. The client machine remote authentication server version, there's a holy war about whether you should hand out versions. It makes it very easy to quickly, not necessarily reliably, check to see if somebody's running a vulnerable piece of software so that you can force an upgrade or you can alert the people inside the corporation. At the same time, it makes it very easy for attackers to come along and say, vulnerable, not vulnerable, vulnerable, not vulnerable, I'm going to waste my time or I'm not. The client machine net BIOS name, more information leak, vendor identification, next slide, this one keeps going. Server vendor identification, the internal virtual tunnel IP address. Now that's an interesting thing to know. If you're running net 10 internally, now I know you're running net 10. If you're running some other unrouted or unadvertised network, This is a bit of information about how you're set up. The internal DNS server is handed off to the client. This is kind of cute. The Win servers, the client username, now the killer one, enough information to retrieve the user's password, enough information to retrieve the initialization value used inside of MTPE, because it has a little counter going on that resets every 256 bytes, or 256 packets, sorry. Current values for the encrypted client server packets. If you have the initialization value used inside of MTPE, you can decrypt it all on your own, just watching, obviously. This is, you have the user's password, you have the key to the encryption. Next. That one's out of order. Things to think about when implementation kits. I can't say this enough. This is an extension of your perimeter. Do you want a 95 box to be the extension of your perimeter? I'm not saying 95 boxes are bad. Microsoft says that they can't be secure or that they're not secure. If you're using it as an extension of your firewall, you're at odds with yourself. You're trusting each end node not to be the weakest link. You can't do this. This is completely unscalable. Is it multi-platform? No. These are things you got to think about. What's in the tunnel and what's not? We noticed inside DPTP there was a bunch of information that wasn't inside the tunnel. A bunch of it that probably should have been. The other thing about what's in the tunnel and what's not. Oh, here we go. I'm going to skip to the bottom. Is the connection actually encrypted? This is from the user standpoint. And I believe a while back there was a Kerberized R client, RSH or something. And normally the encryption is enabled with a dash X, correct? And this Alex pointed out to me that, geez, you type in, RSH dash X for the Kerberized encryption, and if you can't do it, it'll revert back to the other one and not tell you. I think they fixed that, or else you fixed it for them, or whatever. But this happens. It's like when you do an SSH thing, and it says SSH tunnel not available, reverting to insecure method. Well, imagine if it did that, but just didn't tell you. The only thing worse than no security is a false sense of security. Does the client offer the necessary capability to protect itself? Is there a way of filtering IP packets at the client before it gets handed to the client's IP stack? This is the reason I love IP filter so much. Do you basically have a firewall on your client? A good firewall. If anybody knows of a good firewall, please tell me. Trojan programs. What you're doing is you're hopping from two different trust levels of networks. You're hopping from a trusted network to an untrusted network. Even if they do everything completely correct, and when you are actually VPN'd in, you are only on the internal network. And when you are not VPN'd in, and you're connected through your ISP, you're just over there. This is the same thing as taking a laptop on a classified network, doing some work, unplugging it, and taking it to an unclassified network. This isn't the brightest thing to do. If somebody really wants you, but you have to wonder if somebody really wants you or not, there are different ways of subverting this. If you have a stateful filter, guess what? If they get you while you're outside and you bring the box inside, they initiate the connection from the inside to out with the back channel. But if maybe they just want to grab some information, suck up the packets on the internal net, when you take it back out to the external net, they are available for later collection. Maybe they dump them off in SNMP traps. Maybe they dump them out in ICMP packets. These are all tools that are being used right now. Next slide. Two Microsoft people at the very back of the room when he just choked me, beat me to a fruit juice, he pulled back of this, I'm sure. If the clients aren't secure, the end nodes can't be trusted. Maybe this is what they're saying. Maybe they're saying, everybody said go to NT. 95 is no good, go to NT. Well, then stop enabling 95 boxes to be the end nodes. If it's true that security can't be done in them, don't even make an effort at it. Drop the compatibility, drop that, make it really painful for people. They will come over, you own them already. extension of perimeter within nodes like that for remote locations, it's not like small business offices, if it's for the traveling, you know, salesperson, it's completely unscalable. This is also my other big gripe with IDS at the end nodes. It can't be done, and it's unscalable. If you've got to fix one bug and you've got 300,000 machines, good luck. Don't trust users to be good sources of entropy. People are extremely predictable. Don't use stream ciphers in a datagram environment.
Yeah. I didn't actually write the end part on there.
Stream ciphers are good. Don't take that one at face value. Don't use stream ciphers. Stream ciphers have their place. They don't like being in lossy environments.
Yeah, standard one assume the worst is out there, blah, blah, blah.
Okay, VPNs are easier to trust, at least one level up from the end machine. You know, I say I don't like VPNs. I don't like VPNs that are going out to the extreme perimeter. I like some of the NFC stuff, and I forget what the name of the security router is, the company. I like some of the sunscreen stuff. I like the notion of encrypting, you know, between perimeter points, between the actual, you know, routers or leg up from the routers with firewall one boxes or something. That kind of makes sense to me. You control the filters on these different remote boxes. You control what's going into those end clients. You don't have to control the end clients. The end clients, if they're inherently frail and weak, you don't want to be chasing after all of them. If they're talking, they're coming through you, you massage, you model the traffic, you encrypt it, you send it back over through this tunnel, you control those points. Those points are manageable. Even in a huge corporation, you're not talking 300,000 routers, you know, that are connected to as endpoints to the public internet. Of course, if you are, you know, big networks like BSI or whatever else, you might have 300,000 routers just scattered around the internet. But those aren't your internal to external borders for your company. Next one. That's it. Okay. Well, I know a lot of this was really, really basic and rehashes.
I hate to say it, but it needs to be said over and over again, because maybe we'll find the correct way to say it where people will actually listen and implement it correctly. If there are any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them. Russ. The question was, asymmetric routing is basically critical to extremely large corporations. Have I seen anything that I like? Asymmetric routing can be critical. I've seen many large corporations that have stateful filters in place. The asymmetric routing is fine if it's amongst internal places. Usually you don't have to have a tremendous amount of asymmetric routing going from the internal corporate stuff to the outside world. You can force the routes around that way. It gets interesting when you start talking about HSRP and basically, you know, failing over with routers. However, those can still be taken into account. That's not tremendously asymmetric. It's when you're going through multiple stateful filter boxes as part of the asymmetric thing that everything falls apart. You can come from a couple of different routers and still basically understand the state of the endpoints. I really like sunscreen. I think Sun did themselves a disservice by not really pushing forward with it. For those people who aren't familiar with what the sunscreen box was, Lord only knows what they're doing with it right now. It's a stateful filter that's a hub. You know, it's a big glorified hub. So it's not addressable, well, other than through skip on the management port, which is entirely encrypted, but, and we can argue whether skip is useful or not. This is what do you attack in a hub. If it's a dumb hub that's just passing packets, it doesn't have a MAC address. It doesn't have an IP address. You know, it dwarfs packets right there. I thought that was a pretty clever idea. Yes, Tom. I couldn't hear you. Can you say it again? That's true for anything. The statement was, it's reading packets and it's processing them, and if there's a bug in it, you can kill it. If there's a bug in it, you can kill it. Yes, and as we know, everybody writes buggy software, and thus everything can be killed. Well, there are two ways of doing it. I mean, obviously, the statement was, how do you really attack a firewall? Do you attack the firewall itself, or do you attack the way it's actually processing the packets that are going back and forth? Did I say that correctly for you? Okay, well, if you're going to, there's an easier way of doing it, which is basically looking at where they box the policy. You know, if I see that they're allowing connection support 23 from anywhere, or ADR services, the firewall is doing exactly what they told it to do. So there's really a couple other layers outside of that. To the firewall one box, I might just go SNMP directly to the box. There are reasons to attack the actual firewall itself. And people will say, you can set up a firewall to be secure or insecure. Some of them you can't set up to be secure. Some of them have bugs in how they're processing the packets. I would happen to be, don't want to stand up here like basically, pitching for Sun with sunscreen. But after looking at their product for quite some time, I'm happier with how it handles the packets than a lot of the other ones. The one thing, of course, to watch out for is inside skip stuff in management and be very, very afraid of the key discovery. Other questions? Oh, for the paper?
Yeah.
The paper was called Crypt Analysis of Microsoft's Implementation of PPTP. So we looked at Microsoft's implementation of PPTP. There are a bunch of places out there. There are a bunch of them that I haven't looked at. The only other real VPNs I've looked at are the pretty high-end ones, for instance, the sunscreen stuff, some of the firewall ones, some of I can't remember the name of that routing. NSC, was that it? Is that it? Okay, BorderGuard. Those are the ones I've looked at. This is the one that Bruce and I did the paper on. It was, it's kind of like beating up a town drunk, but once in a while. I'm not getting that free lunch, am I? other questions? I forgot that they were also printed inside of the booklet.
This is a bit of an aside, but I kind of figured if somebody brought it up from yesterday's discussions about switches or whatever, we could actually start talking about it. Big companies are really starting to look at big layer 2 switches for moving traffic around. I remember I wanted just the ability internally for different business units where I was doing some contract work for to have 100 megabit Cisco routers. I needed maybe about 8 or 10 different ports on it. This was almost impossible to get, and this was only a couple months ago. And I'm like, well, everybody's running 100 megabit. What do you do? Everybody said, buy a switch. I don't want a switch. I just want to be able to put a stupid access control list inside here and say human resources doesn't have to browse the R&D web server. These new switches are becoming more and more impressive in their abilities to what they're doing. The new switches are willing to filter on layer 3 stuff. Some of them are willing to filter on layer 4 stuff. They're also willing to do virtual LANs inside of, based upon your MAC address, based upon layer 2. Cabletron has a particular switch, which is a router, a switch. It does their secure virtual LANs. It's, you name it. It's a dicer, a slicer, it's a dessert topping, and a floor wax. One of the big things about these is that they say, okay, I can set up different domains, different LANs. I've got one big honking switch. I mean, it's a studly device. It's like the equivalent. You can handle like 603, 12 OC3s in it, you name it. These things are moving. So to be even more studly, we'll add the word security into it, which isn't the way to be studly if you don't do it correctly. So I say I'm in virtual LAN A, and there's virtual LAN B, and we can separate each other in the switch. We're all going through the same piece of hardware, but I can't talk to
virtual LAN B if I'm in virtual LAN A. So there are some parallels to the notion of tunneling, because you're tunneling through different switches, you're tunneling through different networks even, because you don't necessarily have to have a direct inter-switch link between all of these to do it. There are encapsulation protocols. Some of these will enable you to virtually tunnel these LANs over far networks to then be re-stripped apart, almost ATM-ish like, at the other end. That's why we're in there and talk about it. But if people want to bring up cases with switches, and they can go at different ways of approaching them or bypassing them, I'd be more than happy to. Next.